for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Some scientists say the volume of oil pouring into the Gulf of Mexico from the BP spill could be at least 10 times higher than previously estimated. Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan spent 2 days seeking support on Capitol Hill, and the Senate voted to institute tough new credit rating rules and to remove the government's formal endorsement of a handful of firms. Joining me for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Morton Kondratyev, Roll Call. Welcome to you, Mort.
Good to see you, Diane.
Good to have you here. Gene Cummings of Politico, an old-timer on the program.
Good morning.
And syndicated columnist Steve Roberts, who is one of my favorite sit-in hosts.
Thank you, Diane.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about this BP oil spill. Estimates have been greatly underestimated, Steve.
Well, they have been. NPR, among others, have been doing some very good investigative reporting. It goes well beyond, the mistakes go well beyond underestimating the oil flow. We're seeing it's absolutely clear two things are true. One was that they ran right through some red warning signals, as the Wall Street Journal put it this week, that clearly there was danger in what they were doing, clearly both in the long term and the short term. We're now learning that the Minerals Management Agency brushed aside the warnings about from their own scientists. This echoes of the Bush administration, of their own scientists, about the dangers to the ecosystem of the Gulf. There were warnings that this particular well was a danger, and they went ahead and went with it anyway. And the final thing that's absolutely clear, Diane, is they have no idea what to do with it. That they didn't have, not only did they underestimate the danger, but they did not put in place the mechanisms that would be able to cope with a spill of this magnitude.
Gene?
The ramifications for this are just, a pebble in the pond, as they say, that they'll go on and on and on, rippling forever. And the great tragedy is that we haven't even seen the beginning of the true environmental impact. What we see now is, the oil on top of the ocean, but what's happening to all of the ecosystem below that, we have not been able to assess. And once it lands, the devastation that it could come then, we haven't even seen a hint of what's coming.
You know what's fascinating, Mort? In an interview with the Guardian newspaper, Mr. Hayward, the head of BP, said the spill is relatively tiny, that the Gulf of Mexico is a very big ocean. The amount of volume of oil and dispersant we're putting into it is tiny in relation to the total water volume.
Yeah, he obviously doesn't get it. That's terrible PR. I mean, it violates the whole example the Tylenol mess. What you do is you get your hands around it, you acknowledge it, you put it out in the open. I think BP has upgraded its response to the spill in terms of personnel and effort, and they're trying every which way they can do to contain to get the oil out.
But
it's their responsibility.
Well,
obviously.
Exactly. And as Steve said, they're throwing everything at it, including golf balls, pantyhose, trash.
It's astounding.
Right. I mean, yeah. It's astounding.
Right. It's astounding that they would not be prepared for a spill of this magnitude. Their own scientists warned it was possible. Everybody knows it was possible. And they don't seem to have a clue. Every day we get a new story about some newfangled fix. And Hayward, the head of BP, did say in another interview when he was down in the Gulf region, he did say we made mistakes for the first time this week. But they've been slow. They've been very slow in acknowledging their culpability.
As much as he may acknowledge they made mistakes, the testimony of those three CEOs up on Capitol Hill was appalling, was simply appalling, where you had the CEO of BP blamed the CEO of Transocean, who turns and blames the CEO of Halliburton, who then turns it all back around and blames the CEO of BP. As the three of them sat there, it reminded me of the three monkeys. See no evil, hear no evil, speak
well,
no
know,
evil. I mean, nobody there really took any responsibility for what's happening.
What it all reminds me of is the murder on the Orient Express. I mean, it's possible that everybody was
that's
involved.
True. That's true.
In addition to which, there's the Cameron Corporation, which was the maker of this plug, the blowout prevention device that was supposed to work. None of it worked. I mean, there were batteries that were dead. There were leakages in hydraulic fuel. I mean, nobody is exactly sure, and I'm sure that they all were putting the blame on everybody else for liability reasons.
Right, and that's what I want to talk about is liability question, BP or one of the companies is trying to cap their liability at, what, $28 million?
$28 million. This is Transocean. This is the Swiss company which actually owned the rig. Now, they're trying to make a claim under a law that was passed in 1851. It's a somewhat antiquated law. It seems to be a legal maneuver to try to consolidate the cases in one court. They want it in federal court, not state court, where it would go before a judge, not a jury, which is much more liable to award very high damages. It seems to be a legal maneuver, but it's outrageous. $27 million drop in the
Are
bucket.
Are they going to get that more?
No, it's going to go much
more. I mean, they've already gotten more than $400 million from their insurance company.
Isn't that outrageous that they get paid first? You've got 11 people
who die. They've got the insurance.
I'm sure that it's the lawyers telling the CEO, listen, we've got this out. Let's do it. See what we can do. Throw something against the wall and see if it sticks. Mm-hmm. It can't possibly stick.
Okay. Has the Obama administration done everything it could to try to put this mess in order, Gene? What is its responsibility?
Well, it's an awkward position for the administration. In part, in the beginning, they had to rely upon the assessment that BP gave as to what was happening with that oil spill, and BP's initial assessment was ridiculously conservative. They said it was very small, and the amount of oil flowing into the Gulf was a very, very, very small amount, all of which proved untrue. So initially, the administration sent down scientists. They made any military resources available to BP. But BP seemed to have it in hand. Huh. And then, of course, it's all unraveled from there. Now they're throwing everything they've got at it. But it's still awkward because this is a privately owned operation. And, it's BP's responsibility to clean it up.
It's also awkward because just prior to the oil spill, the administration announced it was in favor of offshore drilling.
Yeah, drill, baby, drill. Clearly, that's off the table now. In fact, the energy bill proposed by Senators Lieberman and Kerry this week, ratcheted way back on proposals for offshore drilling.
Gave states the option to back out.
And clearly a state like California, any Pacific state would back out of this. But also you have the regulatory issue. The Minerals Management Association, or it's not association,
Service.
Minerals Management Commission, which is in charge of this, clearly was victimized by a syndrome we see again and again. We're actually seeing it on Wall Street, too, which is that the regulatory agency goes native, and it becomes entwined with the companies that they're regulating. There's a revolving door. People go back and forth between the agency and these companies. And over and over again, the environmental scientists at the management agency said there are huge risks here, and over again they were overruled. Their reports were written because the head of the agency, which is in bed with the industry, pushed all of these warnings aside.
So now what the proposal is to separate that agency into two parts.
Right. Well, this agency was funded by the oil companies that it was supposed to regulate. I mean, this is a similar we've seen this pattern before, as you say, on Wall Street with the bonding agencies, for example, which have been
the bond rating agencies
paid by the people who are inventing the securities. So it's conflict of interest. So what Ken Salazar, the Interior Secretary, has done is to try to is going to split up the agency so that the people who are responsible for granting the permits are not the same people are the ones who are overseeing how the how they're performing from a safety standpoint, which is a good thing. I mean, that, there should be two different agencies involved.
But will you run into the same thing you have at the FDA? You still have this revolving door. What are the safeguards going to be, even if you do divide this organization into two parts, Jane?
It's still going to remain, a very tricky environment, simply adding to the question of who gives the lease and who oversees the performance. That's being divided. But this is also the agency charged with collecting money from these oil rigs.
Exactly.
The proceeds that are paid to the federal government. And so you have that aspect of it, that it also can be a conflict, because it's that agency is under pressure to collect every dime that they can from the companies and to generate income from these leases.
Yesterday, we heard that commission generates about $14 billion, and that what you need to do is add more tax to the oil companies to cover this kind of mishap. All right, we'll take a short break. Gene Cummings is at Politico, and Morton Kondracki is at Roll Call. Steve Roberts is syndicated columnist. Welcome back, and for this week's Domestic Hour, the Friday News Roundup, Steve Roberts is here. He's a professor of journalism at George Washington University, as well as syndicated columnist. Gene Cummings is Politico's assistant managing editor in charge of Enterprise. Morton Kondracki is executive editor and columnist for Roll Call. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Here's an interesting email from Linda in Falls Church. Think of the disasters, she says, that have taken place. The financial disaster, the coal mine disaster, the oil spill disaster. They all point to corporations doing whatever it takes to make short-term money without regard to effects and inadequate regulation. And now the Supreme Court says those same corporations can use unlimited money to get who they want elected. The future is terrifying, she says, Steve.
Well, I think that she's absolutely right about the weakness of these regulatory regimes. And as we were saying, there's a connection here.
Absolutely.
Between what happened in the Gulf, what's happened in Wall Street, what's happened in the mining industry. The syndrome is the same. These are weak regulatory agencies which are far too beholden to the corporate interests that they regulate.
How has that happened?
Well, I think it happens over a natural period of time as you get a revolving door of people who move. They're the experts. So they move from the regulatory agency, then they get big jobs at the corporations. And it's a culture. It's a subculture. And there are many of them. The other thing, though, that the email points up is just a few weeks ago, the Pew Research Organization, very high-quality organization here, showed that only 22% of Americans have confidence in government. And yet, here we have three examples of where the lack of government supervision is critical. And you have conservative governors throughout the South saying their first reaction to the spill is, where's the federal government, after having attacked the federal government and eroded confidence in the federal government? That's also part of the problem.
Well, in the financial services field, the simple explanation was is that the bankers were smarter than the regulators. I mean, if you have an opportunity to make $100 million in salary and bonuses and stuff like that in the banking industry, you're likely to have a higher IQ than you are if you're going to be a bureaucrat at the SEC. I'm sorry, and so these people are inventing new ways of making money, and the regulators can't keep up.
Think also what you have here is both of these industries had gone for a long period of time without problems. And that generates an arrogance and a hubris.
But BP had problem after problem, Jane.
But not like this. Not like this, where it threatens the entire offshore drilling industry in the United States. This is huge. They hadn't had anything like this.
All right, let's move on to the Kerry Lieberman bill. Is now a good time to introduce a climate bill, Jean?
Well, they certainly think it is. They think it is a good time because the country is focused on our oil supplies, on the energy sector. So they feel like this actually will drive the debate in a way that the public will pay attention to it. I don't know if they've made the right calculation or not. Obviously, Senator Lindsey Graham, who was a co-author of the legislation, feels the time is not right. But I think his reasons have really nothing to do with the oil spill. They're political. But at any rate, I think for now, that and the action by the EPA, which is already starting to try to regulate carbon, will put a lot of pressure on the Senate to move.
So what are the chances, Mark?
I doubt that they're going to pass it this year. I was very impressed, by the way, with the coalition of people who were there at the announcement and who have blessed this bill, including the natural gas industry, Boone Pickens, the nuclear power industry, even the electric utility industry. All have said that this is a good, a reasonable plan. Despite all that, the Senate calendar is so clogged. I mean, you'd think this is May. Well, they have till the end of the year. Not so. They're going to have to process appropriations bills. They're going to have to process the Kagan nomination to the Supreme Court. And that plus the difficulty of getting 60 votes in the Senate, I just think, is going to delay it for the year.
And elections coming up, of course. You mentioned Elena Kagan. How'd she do yesterday on Capitol Hill, Mark?
Well, all the reports seem to be good. I mean, she's a very smart and likable person. So she has these visits, and she successfully handles them, so far as we can tell.
I thought it was interesting that Arlen Specter told reporters that during their meeting, Elena Kagan criticized the Supreme Court, saying it takes too few cases. Senator Specter said she also told him that one justice was less than forthcoming during his or her confirmation, and she would not name names.
Well,
I thought that was interesting.
The question that raises is she going to be forthcoming? I mean, she will be asked all the questions and be given lots of opportunities to say what she thinks and what her judicial philosophy is. And, you know, she, in a 1995 memo that's been unearthed as part of the discovery of who was Elena Kagan, she criticized the process that people are the vacuous and vapid in their in this hearing process, that you never get to the bottom of who a justice is. So she has an opportunity to educate the whole country about who she is and where she's coming from.
Yeah, but that's not going to happen. Right. In fact, she has said quite candidly, that was then, this is now. Now that I'm the nominee, I understand that vapid and vacuous is the way to go because you don't want to be pinned down.
I don't think you're giving her enough credit.
Well, I think she's a, I agree with Mort, she's a very strong nominee
exactly.
and a smart woman.
Yes.
But I also think she understands the politics here. We're in a period of, this is a totally scripted charade. You have the Democrats who are going to be for her. You have the Republicans who are going to be against her. They're going to be against her because...
Not all of them.
Well, you'll have a handful. Now, you'll have... There were seven Republicans who voted for her when she was approved as Solicitor General just 14 months ago. But the larger political reality is that the Supreme Court is extremely important to the conservative base of the Republican Party. It has been for years, ever since school prayer and abortion decisions helped create the modern Christian conservative movement. And this is a golden chance to appeal to the base, to raise money, to get them energized for the fall campaign, to raise the stakes and say, you know, go out there and vote because a few more seats in the Senate, we can block the next Supreme Court nominee, we can block other federal judges, which are very important to you.
So they're going to use her nomination.
Every single day, and they're going to use it for political reasons, and we know what's going to happen.
I agree with him completely. I think this changes the election year, changes the dynamics of the hearing as well. I think we're going to see a lot of posturing, a lot more of politically loaded questions and accusations. We're going to see a lot of self-righteousness. We're going to see, you know, peacocks on parade when this hearing comes up. And it's all about the political season. And I'd be frankly surprised if she keeps all seven Republican votes because
okay.
of the politics.
All right. And the political season has already begun. We had big primary wins and losses this week, Mort.
Well, the surprising one was that Bob Bennett, who is as conservative as you can possibly be, senator from Utah in his third term, was denied even the opportunity to run in the primary by a state convention in Republican state convention in Utah, because he had the audacity, ideological audacity, to actually vote for the TARP bill. Which was, promoted by George Bush. So bailouts of any kind are just anathema to the Republicans.
So wouldn't that indicate that people, voters out there in Utah at least, are anti-incumbent right now?
Yes, that's part of it. That's a big part of it. But there's also this purity campaign going on within the Republican Party all across the country.
But how do you define purity?
Well, it is back to the Constitution. That is limited government. I mean, you've got there was an article that the candidate actually who got the highest number of votes at this Utah convention wrote. I guess it was in the Post, Washington Post, this morning, saying that the Constitution says that the government is only supposed to protect us against enemies, foreign enemies, and the states are supposed to do everything else, and that the federal government is not supposed to do anything if you read this article.
I think the idea that they have the purity test, that they have some real definition of what this test is ridiculous. I think it's a veil. It's the veil they hide behind because they want to get incumbents. They want to change government. They're mad at their own party leaders, the Republicans are, and the independents are put out with everyone. And the Democrats aren't happy either because Representative Mollohan, a Democratic House member, also lost in his primary, which I think is a benefit for the Democratic Party in general because he certainly would have lost in the general election.
I don't think it's a veil. I think it's sincere. But I also think it's potentially very damaging to the Republican Party. They're not going to pay a price in Utah because a very conservative state has not elected a Democrat since the 70s. But look what's going to happen next week in Kentucky. You have a Republican primary where Trey Grayson, Secretary of State, endorsed by Mitch McConnell, is being challenged by Rand Paul, much more conservative guy, son of Ron Paul, the libertarian congressman. Look what's happening in Florida where Charlie Crist is basically thrown out of the party.
look what's happening with Arlen Specter and Blanche Lincoln.
And Blanche Lincoln. I mean, there are Democratic jihadists, too. But the fact is that the Tea Party movement is a very volatile movement for the Republicans, and they have to find a way to harness it, but not have it destroy the Republican Party and pull them so far to the right. And
you
that's a real
think
danger.
It's equally as dangerous for the Democrats as it is.
Well, I do think that the challenge to Blanche Lincoln is nuts. I mean, the idea that she should be voting like a New Yorker in Arkansas and can keep her seat just doesn't make any sense
at
all.
I don't think it's the same. I think the Democrats are picking and choosing their candidates for more deliberately. I think that the Republican base is just really mad at everyone.
Gene Cummings at Politico, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk for a minute about what's happening as far as Wall Street is concerned. You're now prosecutors, security regulators looking into whether J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Deutsche Bank, UBS misled investors about their role in mortgages. Mort.
Right. These cases are very difficult to prove. The allegation is, number one, these are preliminary investigations. No charges have been filed.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, we don't know where they're going to go. The SEC has filed a civil complaint against Goldman Sachs on a similar ground. So the issue is, did these banks and investment houses sell these securities to people saying that they were sound securities?
Knowing
that they had really set them up in order to, at the behest of a short seller who was going to bet against them, so that they were designed to fail, in effect. And did the investment houses themselves short sell them, knowing how they'd been put together, but misrepresent them to people who were going to buy them, thinking that they were going to grow in value.
What about Cuomo in New York?
Well, that's
Steve.
That's part of the regulatory picture here. I mean, what is the protection against this kind of chicanery? You supposedly have an independent agency, these bond rating agencies, which are supposed to give you accurate information about how useful, how valid an investment they are. But they are, as we've learned, dependent on the information they get from the banking houses. And, as Moore pointed out earlier, they're financed. They get fees from the banking industry to rate these offerings.
Is there a revolving
door there?
Sure.
Oh, yes,
well,
just like
same
just,
thing.
Exactly. Yeah. That's why we were saying that there is a common problem. But what Cuomo's trying to get at is one piece of this network is, can you rely on these rating agencies? And if the information they were provided was deliberately faulty, then you have the possibility of a fraud case.
Yeah. This is another one.
The hard part in all of this is going to be proof. Because they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they did this intentionally, that they knew they would fail. And the fact is, all of these banks held on to some of these securities, which is why they lost billions when the market tanked too. And so it's going to be very, very difficult to prove. And, you know, part of what makes Wall Street Wall Street is that it is an amoral place. It's just all about money. And they're all betting against one another all the time. It's a shark pit.
Okay.
And so how is this different than the instincts that they display on any other trading that they do in another sector? It's going to be difficult to discern.
And what about the Franken Amendment, Mort, that I gather would really change the relationship?
Well, the Senate passed two amendments, which seems to be in conflict with one another. The Franken Amendment says that there's going to be a lot of power given to the SEC to say which rating agency will handle what kind of security. And then there's the Lemieux Amendment, the senator from Florida, along with Maria Cantwell, who's a Democrat from Washington, which would lift the federal imprimatur from all these bonding agencies, rating agencies, which basically that imprimatur said that if you have a stamp of approval from one of these big rating agencies, that you're okay. If they grade you AAA, that you can rely on that. And the federal government, and so one of them is a free market. The Lemieux thing is a free market thing where the banks would have to go out and find their own raiders, and people would be suspicious of the raiders. The Franken Amendment will sort of install the government imprimatur as a even strengthen the government imprimatur. It is a
totally
difficult
issue.
One of them will have to fall away in the conference.
And in the meantime, the federal budget deficit hit an all-time high for April. While all this is going on, Steve, quickly.
At a huge number, $82 billion. It indicates that the annual deficit is likely to go over $1.5 trillion. And that is the huge problem out there that no one's dealing with.
Syndicated columnist Steve Roberts will take a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones, read your email, your tweets, and your messages on Facebook.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news about politics, culture, and lifestyles at Germany.info. By the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And by Tarcher Penguin, with Jeremy Rifkin's new book, The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis, in stores and online. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The UK has a new prime minister. Afghanistan's president wraps up a visit to the U.S., and the EU adopts a plan to address the sovereign debt crisis. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the domestic hour of our Friday News Roundup with Mort Kondracki of Roll Call, Gene Cummings of Politico, syndicated columnist Steve Roberts, also at George Washington University. Let's open the phones first to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Jess. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the things you guys were discussing earlier had to do with this principle in the environmental world of the polluter pays and how BP is going to end up paying for this cleanup in the Gulf and their insurance companies and all of the other associated companies. One of the things that happened during the Bush administration was that they did away with the Superfund tax, which was levied against chemical companies to help fund the government response at the federal level and also through pass-through at the state level to these kinds of environmental catastrophes. And I wonder if your panel has any thoughts on whether we ought to be considering reinstating that kind of tax just for these kinds of circumstances to make sure that we have a level of preparedness at the state and federal government level to be able to manage these incidents effectively.
I think that's a great question, Gene.
Well, they are. There's already talk in the Senate about passing a gas tax or a tax on the gas big oil companies that would indeed raise money and try to cover some of the costs that would be related to a spill like this.
There's another question that the caller raises. Yes, BP has said it would be responsible for the cleanup, but the definition of cleanup is still to be discussed. And say the shrimpers and other people who are indirectly affected, a lot of the economic interests, will they be compensated? That's still very much up in the air as a question.
Talk about, Steve, during the break, you mentioned something about a global fund to pay off people who...
No, it's what I'm talking about is that on Wall Street, they're very worried that if these cases go to court, the Cuomo investigation you mentioned,
right,
the Goldman Sachs case,
right,
they're very worried that a lot of their internal... memos will come out that they're, as Gene said, the shark-like tactics will come out. They don't want to fight these issues in court. And there's talk in the New York Times this morning of a global settlement that is a negotiated settlement of these claims and of these cases that, well, they would make some restitution, but without necessarily admitting criminal guilt or even civil guilt, because Wall Street does not want to go to, even though they claim they can win these cases, they would pay a heavy price. In the end, look, the markets depend on public confidence. And if a big case erodes confidence in these companies and the markets, even if they win the case, they lose in terms of public credibility, which is a devastating impact on their business.
All right. To,
you know, one, just
go
one,
ahead,
one point
sure.
on this. Talk about sharks. Another school of sharks is swimming around, and that's the trial lawyer community of the country. They are taking up cases all over the Gulf area. And, you know, lots of times trial lawyers have a bad name. But in this case, they are sort of the carrion eaters. They're going to go in there and they are going to, everybody who's got a claim against an oil company, whether it's a shrimper or somebody who was on the rig or the members of their families, they're all going to hire up lawyers, and this is going to go on, and the litigation is going to be astronomically expensive before
and
this is over.
Didn't BP try to get
yes.
in there with a $5,000 offer?
Right. They were trying to get, as I've read it anyway, they on the way back to land, they were trying to get various people on these men on the crew people on the
who survived.
Yeah, to sign a waiver against, you know, suing.
This is a John Grisham novel as well.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Fred in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning to you. I have deep and proud roots in the state of Alabama, even though I'm calling you from Michigan, and yet I am continually embarrassed by Senator Jeff Sessions, particularly as he harps on this issue of experience relative on the bench relative to the Supreme Court nominee. I wonder how much experience matters to the panel, and I wonder also the extent to which the panel feels that some of this is fueled by his own bitterness, having been passed up for court appointments in the past.
I don't know about the personal bitterness, but there is that issue involving him. I think he's basically carrying water. This is the major Republican theme, leadership theme, at least against Kagan, that she doesn't have judicial experience. You know, they're acting as though this lady has never been in a courtroom. Which is ridiculous. She was a clerk to Abner Mikva, who was a D.C. Court of Appeals judge. She was a clerk to
Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah.
Thurgood Marshall. She's been Solicitor General. You know, she's been in and around courtrooms and reading cases and all of that for a very long time. She is not inexperienced in the law.
And she certainly is as experienced as at least two other Republican members of the court. John Roberts, who had very little. He had been on the federal bench, but only for a few years. And Clarence Thomas had been on the federal bench for a blink of an eye before he was nominated. So the notion that somehow she is less experienced than at least two of the sitting conservatives is not fair.
I think what it demonstrates is that they don't have much. They're searching for some kind of way to undermine her nomination, some argument to make, some questions to probe, and they don't have much. This just reminds me so much of Sotomayor's confirmation hearing, where we spent 3 days talking about a wise Latino woman. You know, one thing she said was the only thing they had, and they don't have much on
Kagan. Actually, they've got less on Kagan than they had on Sotomayor.
She's never written a judicial opinion.
Yeah. Let's talk a little about three men taken into custody in connection to the failed Times Square bombing. What's the latest on that investigation, Steve?
Well, the latest is these arrests are following the adage, follow the money, that the strong suspicion that this accused bomber could not have acted alone, and that how do you track his movements, and how do you track what roots and connections he had to larger global conspiracies? And they're trying to follow the money. And what they've said as a result of these arrests, we don't know yet whether these were witting conspirators. We do know that they funneled money to this guy. We don't know how involved they were in the plot. But this is a good example of good police work in trying to find the connections that this guy might have had.
What about the connections to Pakistan? And Pakistan has arrested a couple of people.
They did. They arrested people who they believe helped him get him into the camps where he could learn how to make bombs and associate with the folks over there. And that those arrests and long term could be, you know, very troubling, because if it is, we don't know yet if the Pakistan Taliban is involved in this or not. There are indicators that they are involved, and if they are, that could complicate our relationship with Pakistan at a time when we're trying to, you know, lean on them and work with them to try to clear out some of the Al-Qaeda folks over there. So it could be a very big complication for us.
What's curious to me about this is that every day there's a bomb that's set off in Pakistan by the Pakistani Taliban successfully. Wherever this guy went to school in Pakistan, he was taught by incompetence. I mean, this bomb was so badly put together that you cannot believe that he was instructed by any kind of experienced bomb makers.
But we can't always count on incompetence.
Of course. Oh, no, I know.
That's the concern. Let's take a call in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Ms. Reams. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
It was previously stated that the administration had to rely on BP for an assessment of what happened. Well, in my experience, when an accident happens involving two people out on the street, for example, the police come and they investigate what happened. And I think that as much of a supporter as I am of Obama, I really do think that the government should have come onto the scene and should not have just relied on BP to determine what happened, especially given their record, their performance record in this area. I think that they should have come and not only made an effort to save the lives of those who were lost, but also to determine promptly the amount of oil that was being spilled into the Gulf. And I'll take your response.
All right. Thanks for calling. That's putting the responsibility on the government as opposed to BP.
Well, you know, hindsight is helpful. I mean, initially it was a rescue mission, and the federal government did participate in trying to, rescue whoever had gotten off of the rig. But if you look at history, the only closest model that we have in recent history is the Exxon Valdez. And in that case, the government had nothing to do with that. They made Exxon do everything, and there are people from the administration at that time who said they were under strict orders not to say one word, to have no contact with Exxon, because it was a private company, their spill, you clean it up, you pay for it.
And, you know, we still have not gotten all the money from the Exxon Valdez spill.
Well, you know, I think part of what the caller is also talking about is short-term and long-term. There definitely will be government investigations of this. But in the short term, it's an emergency, and it's BP who knows what's going on under the in their own well, not the federal government. But obviously, the caller's right. There's a long-term role for the federal government to determine exactly what went wrong. We've been talking over and over this morning about the failure of the regulatory regime to watch them closely enough, and lessons have to be learned here about the dangers of this kind of drilling. Well, as you pointed out, there's talk about expanding drilling offshore.
Exactly.
Well, that's
So there's got to be a tougher oversight.
Well, the administration has obviously got to figure out why this happened and make sure that it doesn't happen again, can't happen again, and that there's a regime in place. If they're going to expand offshore drilling, as the administration said it wants to do, and it has not reversed that ruling,
yet.
It suspended it.
Yet.
Suspended it.
Yeah.
And my impression from talking to administration people is that just as we don't close down the airline industry when there's an airplane crash, we're not going to close off offshore drilling. But the task is to make it safer. So that calls for some sort of a commission here that has subpoena power that can get to the bottom of this, and that would be presumably the basis on which these lawsuits would be settled too, to assign responsibility for once and for all who messed up the most and what the degrees of liability are here.
Mort Kondragiev, roll call. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show and to Byron, Illinois. Good morning, Curtis. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm a retired engineer, and there's a procedure in any engineering project called failure modes and effects analysis. And what you do is you rate everything on two hazards. One is if something goes wrong, how severe are the consequences? You know, and the worst one is you cause loss of life. And the other one is what's the probability it'll go wrong? In other words, if something's going to go wrong just about all the time. And then you put those two numbers together, and it gives you priority a list of things to fix. It sounds like in this valve sitting on the bottom of the Gulf that they did that and threw the thing on the shelf or something. If the batteries were bad and the valves were leaking at the time they put the thing down there, that's gross negligence.
Steve?
That's a pretty good word, gross negligence. We've been talking about that all morning. And it was gross negligence in two ways. First of all, in the way that the well was drilled and pushing ahead, even though there were danger signs that something was going wrong. And the second negligence was failing to have a system in place to deal with a mistake once it was made. Mort was talking about, you know, a commission. That's one of the things that has to be focused on, because offshore drilling will happen and mistakes will happen, and there has to be a far more effective response to those mistakes when they do happen.
But, you know, we keep saying these things, and the accidents continue to occur. What changes have been made, put into place to respond more effectively? It seems to me we are always looking backwards.
That reminds me of life, you know. I mean, there's always something unforeseen that happens that creates a crisis that you have to respond to. The question is, do you respond to it well, and for how long? What kind of regime do you put in place, and for how long does it last? You know, we thought that after the Depression that we'd fixed Wall Street.
Yep.
And we clearly didn't.
Let's talk quickly about the astronauts' testimony on Capitol Hill. You had a couple of former astronauts saying that President Obama's plan not to go to the moon is wrongheaded. You had others saying right on target. What do you think, Steve?
Well, this is in a context here, a budgetary context. I can understand the concerns of Neil Armstrong and Gene Cernan, who said this is a mission to nowhere. Their whole lives have been dedicated to space exploration. They raise the question of other countries filling the vacuum, which would be not only a practical but a symbolic disaster for the United States if someone else gets to the moon. But we were talking earlier, we got a $1.5 trillion deficit this year. And if people are going to get serious about that deficit, they're going to have to start setting priorities. And you can understand where space exploration would not rank as high as some of the other competing priorities.
Well, and it's important to note that they aren't abandoning space exploration. They're making judgments within a certain amount of money, a budget. What do we want to prioritize? And it's deeper space exploration that the government would stay in, and the notion being that further exploration and movement towards the moon is something private industry has already shown an interest in getting into, and would that project grow more vibrantly and faster if unleashed upon it was the open market and the competition of the free market and of private industry.
And those astronauts are worried that private industry wouldn't do as thorough or as safe a job more.
Well, I think it's pretty interesting that this liberal democratic administration wants to yield to the private sector a function that has been previously all government. I think there are realms in which that's the best policy.
Last word, Mort Kondratiev, roll call, Politico's assistant managing editor, Gene Cummings, syndicated columnist, Steve Roberts. He's a journalism professor at George Washington University. I'll be off next week, first to receive the Peabody Award in New York, and then for a voice treatment. I'll be back with you a week from Monday or Tuesday, I hope. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. I'm Diane Rehm.